Hello, Susanna Lopez here, actor turned barrister turned broadcaster turned true crime writer and proud member of Sisters in Crime Australia. Welcome to the Scarlet Stiletto Bites podcast. For over 30 years now, Sisters in Crime Australia has supported our women crime writers, both true crime and fiction, and some criminal literary talent has been unearthed. Among many awards, there's an annual prize for short crime fiction, the Scarlet Stiletto Awards. And for those of you who prefer your stories by ear, in 2023 we commenced this podcast series, Scarlet Stiletto Bites, to celebrate the sisters' 30th anniversary. Each story is short, but not always sweet. Expect twisted tales, quirky humour, and a frisson of feminism. Please support us by following, sharing, reviewing, and generally spreading the word. We have no paywall. How well do we really know the people we love? And after they've gone, what might we suspect them of? Today's story explores these themes. The detail by Fiona Drury, Scarlet Stiletto winner and Great Film Idea Award 2011. When all else fails, I try to hang on to the detail. I tell myself that if I can just concentrate on this blade of grass or the shape of the rain clouds massing over the hills, I'll be okay. I will be able to keep going. I've been trying this for weeks, and my world is getting smaller and smaller because the more I concentrate on the detail, the less I have to think about my life. Yet time rolls on regardless. The soft autumn sun is already fading into chilly nights and cold mornings. When we arrived, the paddocks were scorched and dry. Now they are lush after weeks of rain, and there's even a trickle of water running along the creek. The wood Tom stacked against the old shed, ready to repair the veranda, is now covered with long grass and is a perfect run for the rats and snakes. Nature finds her own comforts. The shed. Wherever I go, my eyes are drawn back to it. The door is closed, but I can imagine it as I saw it that day. The door slightly open, the sun streaming in, and Tom's legs dangling uselessly above the overturned chair. One of his shoes was missing. I spotted it in the corner by the sacks of blood and bone, and I remember thinking how battered and bruised his hands were, and wondering if he had decided at the last minute that he didn't want to die. It was as though he had scrabbled at the rope and rafter with his bare hands. His watch was broken too. I remember that. It had stopped at 3:10 p.m. The geese squawk around me to remind me of what I am doing. I thrust my hand into the sack and watch the grain fall through my fingers. My hands are still shaking. I wonder when that will stop. I climb through the barbed wire fence to check on the goats. Last week, I summoned the energy to ring a neighbour and asked him to take most of them. We'd bought 6 from the market when we first arrived, but we didn't realise they were all pregnant. It was my first feeling of taking control, getting rid of those goats. It was my first acknowledgement to myself that I couldn't stay here forever, waiting for answers that would never come. Yet I still felt trapped in my misery and indecision. I know I have to get away, but everything here reminds me of Tom, and I'm so afraid of leaving him behind me. I pulled Tom's coat around me. It's oilskin and lined with a faded red tartan. I found it in the shed. It had slipped down behind the workbench. Tom's old workmate, Frank, took the rest of Tom's things to the Police Widows and Children's Association charity shop after the funeral. He thought it would be too painful for me to sort through, and I couldn't really say no, even though I wasn't ready to let go of any of it. I'm glad I found the coat. It still smells of Tom. When I wear it, I feel he is wrapping his arms around me and keeping me safe. It's bad enough when someone dies. There is sorrow, anger, loss, acceptance, all the so-called normal stages that you are told to expect. Nothing is normal when your husband kills himself. There can never be enough sorrow, enough anger or denial, and there certainly can't be acceptance. Not yet. Probably never. All that's left is why? After all, we had our whole lives ahead of us, a new start. Maybe that was the point I was missing. Maybe Tom realised this sort of life could never be enough. Not for me. When Tom first told me he was thinking of quitting the force, I thought he was joking. There'd been the death of a witness, but he said it wasn't just that. He said he used to wake up every morning knowing who he was and why he was doing the job, and now the meaning had gone. I supported his decision, of course I did. I even agreed that moving out here would be a good idea. I thought we would make a go of it. I thought it would be fun. I needed to work, that was the trouble. I'm a makeup artist, mostly for television dramas or commercials, and even a couple of small budget films. I thought I could just carry on as before, but I soon found out the truth in the saying, out of sight, out of mind. And we didn't even have internet for the first few weeks, and after a couple of weeks out here, I was itching to get back to civilization. I longed to talk to my friends and workmates. The other problem was that I wasn't used to having Tom around all the time. Before we moved, I was often away, and with Tom working all hours, we sometimes didn't see each other for days, sometimes weeks at a time. We relished our snatches of time together and respected each other's space and silences. That all started to fall apart when we moved here. I could live with not seeing Tom from one week to the next. What I couldn't live with was a silent, moping Tom, and no one else to talk to except a herd of sodding goats. Tom became more and more remote, and locked himself away in the shed or spent hours digging away in the paddock. If Tom and I talked at all during these last weeks, we bickered. I knew we were in trouble, but I didn't think it would end like this. How much must he have grown to hate me to do a thing like that? I wander back to the house, and still I keep glancing over at the shed. I can still picture myself struggling with the upturned chair, trying to get up to Tom to cut him down. It was useless. He was too high up. I screamed and screamed, but no one came. In the end, I telephoned emergency services. I was so frantic I could hardly breathe, let alone speak. The police and ambulance arrived together and asked me endless questions about Tom's state of mind. I must have mentioned his work because Frank and Eddie turned up soon after that. They'd been really close, those three. I suppose you would be working together for 8 years. I have to say, I don't know how I would have managed without them. They organised everything, helped me through the whole ordeal with the coroner, and kept it as quick and painless as it can be when your husband takes his own life. They kept saying that it wasn't my fault, although I guess the subtext was that it must have been a little bit my fault. After all, we'd been married for 6 years, and no note, no farewell. I would like to think I felt something was wrong as soon as I arrived home that day, but I didn't. Otherwise, it wouldn't have taken me half an hour to go to the shed. Half an hour! That's what the police worked out. If I had gone to him straight away, maybe I could have saved him. I realised later that Tom had contrived to get me out of the house. We'd woken to find the landline was not working. Tom became quite agitated about it, and he insisted we report the fault. Without the landline, we were completely cut off because we are outside any wireless network. But reporting the fault meant driving over the ridge to get a signal, and that was nearly 2 kilometres away. I couldn't see the urgency. It wasn't as if we needed to call anyone, apart from Tom's dad, and Tom had spoken to him just the night before. Tom got quite nasty. He said it wouldn't hurt me to get out for a change, and said while I was in town I could pick up some supplies from the hardware store. I got stroppy about him treating me like his builder's mate, and said that maybe I had other plans, although of course I didn't. What plans could I have had out here? Once away from Tom, I started to relax and enjoy the drive. I decided against stopping along the route to call the telephone company and telephone from the cafe instead. After waiting for nearly 20 minutes, they told me the fault wasn't at their end and they would send someone out within 48 hours. I had become so accustomed to staying at home, I'd forgotten about the simple pleasure of sitting in a cafe. I had another coffee and spent a bit of time in the newsagents sorting through a pile of discount books before picking up Tom's supplies. The hardware store was crowded as usual. Tom was always moaning about the place, not enough people and badly set out, so you couldn't find anything yourself. In the end, it took me nearly 40 minutes to get everything on the list. It was only later that I realised the phone had been working all the time. I didn't think of it when I rushed to call the ambulance, nor when the police asked me what happened that day. Strangely, I didn't think about it until the repairman turned up. I don't know if I was trying to kid myself that it was a spur-of-the-moment decision, temporary insanity on Tom's part, but, of course, the phone meant that he had planned it, worked out some way to get me out of the house. He'd probably been planning it for weeks, even months. The house is so cold. I keep Tom's coat on while I make a cup of tea and set the fire. As I crouch down to light the fire, I notice how dirty and dry my hands are and that my ring, my lovely Alexandrite ring that Tom bought me when we first met, is cloudy and dull. He bought it because my name is Alex, and I like to think this namesake ring changes colour with my moods, although I know it is really the light outside and not the light within that makes it change. I light a candle and hold the ring up to the candlelight, and the stone turns the deepest crimson, the colour of heartbreak. I'm so absorbed I realise I've forgotten all about the fire. I thought it had gone out, but as I watch, the newspaper curls and blackens along the edge, and within seconds the kindling takes and the fire crackled into life. I take a gulp of tea and sit back with a feeling of mission accomplished. Maybe it is the warmth of the fire, but for the first time I have a feeling that I can manage. I can get over this. I push my hands down into the coat pockets and sit up with a feeling of resolve. As I do, I feel something deep in the lining of one of the pockets. It's flat and the size of a packet of tissues, but I let myself imagine just for a moment that it is the note I have been searching for, the note that says Tom loved me and it wasn't my fault. Something to say that he knew he was dying of some horrible disease, even though the coroner had ruled that out. Anything to prove I had not helped drive him to his death. I feel around for a hole in the pocket, but there isn't one. It must have slipped through the other pocket and worked its way round. I've lost gloves galore that way. I take off the coat to have a look, but there is no hole. I'm just about to rip open the lining when I see a small repair on the inside of the collar. I recall an exhibition Tom and I went to when we first met. It was at the Tate Gallery in London and showed the work of Russian painters in the 20s who had smuggled their paintings out of the country by sewing them into their clothes. I pulled the stitching open with a fork, push my hand down into the lining of the jacket and pull out a wad of folded paper. I open it and see Tom's scrawling handwriting, and time stands still. For a moment it feels as if Tom is here beside me. I'm so convinced it is a note that I start crying with relief. And it is a few moments before I realise it is simply a list of dates and initials. I scan the pages. The dates start in 2006 and go through to the start of 2010. This is all he left, a useless list. I remember his letters to me when I first returned to the UK. He wrote every day. I wish I still had those letters. Anything to show I mattered to him, that I made a difference to his life. Anything to prove he had once loved me. I sit at the table all evening crying and crying. I feel completely desolate. It occurs to me that if I sit here, just sit here and don't move, I will disappear, simply cease to exist. I know I should eat something, but I've finished the supplies Eddie bought me a few weeks back and I haven't driven into town since that awful day. The telephone rings. I let it go to the answering machine. I know I need to talk to someone, but I can't. I haven't even used the laptop since Eddie fixed it up for me. The thought of turning it on and seeing a snapshot of how my life used to be with emails, contacts, Facebook friends and chat rooms is too much. I try to sleep with Tom's coat still wrapped around me, but I spent the whole night tossing and turning. I keep thinking that Tom must have hidden the list for a good reason. Was he hiding it from me? Perhaps it's a catalogue of wrongdoings. I take the notes from the bedside table. FK and TD, 15 September 2006, 59 Edmonds, 3000. TD and FK, 29 September 2006, Docklands, 5000. FK and TD. FK, could that be Frank Knight? TD, I can't remember anyone with those initials. I go through names starting with T. And then it comes to me. Tom always called Eddie Ted or Teddy. Some of the dates have a tick beside them. These ones include Tom's initials, TM, Tom Morrow. I have no idea what it means, but if it is a catalogue of crimes, it means Tom was involved, which I can't believe. He hated corruption and told me he would have no problem blowing the whistle if he had proof a colleague was on the take. I must have slept because the room is soft with morning light and I can almost smell the promise of a warm day. I stand at the window and look over at the shed. Dappled sunlight is dancing over the roof and for a moment in the moving light I can almost imagine Tom standing there smiling up at me. Suddenly a shaft of bright sunlight illuminates the window and as I raise my hand to shield my eyes, I notice my ring had turned a beautiful deep blue-green, the colour of the deepest ocean, the colour of truth. Then I remember the notes, and as I do, I have the strangest thought. People talk of going cold, and that's exactly what it feels like. I suddenly feel as cold as anger, as clear as the new crisp day. I have been so consumed by my own guilt, I hadn't seen what was really happening. Tom said he would have no problem dobbing someone in for corruption if he had proof. Maybe the hidden note was the proof he needed. That was what he was doing those last few weeks, the secretive phone calls, the hours locked away in the shed, the silences. He'd been preparing his case. Suddenly it all made sense. Of course Frank and Eddie were helpful and turned up so soon after me finding Tom. All the way from Melbourne? That's an easy 3 hours away, even on a good day. Of course, Frank thought it best if he sorted out Tom's things and insisted on Eddie fixing the computer. And the way they helped me through the coroner's court, shielding me from any distressing questions, the whole process, conducted in whispers at the front of the court, the softly spoken evidence on Tom's state of mind from his former colleagues. It was all so obvious now. Tom must have been expecting them that day. That's why he wanted me out of the house. Oh, so typical of him to try to protect me. Did they plan it, or did Tom stand up to them? Threatened to give them up? It must have started as an argument because if they planned it, how did they know I would be out? And if they had planned it, what did they plan for me? I can allow myself to remember now. I have to remember it all. All the detail. The bruised hands. The broken watch. Tom's feet swinging above the chair as I tried to get him down. I have to remember it all, because as Frank had said that day, when he put his arm around my shoulder and gave me a comforting hug, "Don't worry, Alex, we take care of our own." The end. Thanks so much for listening. We'd love to get your feedback and we'd love to reach more listeners. Our website is sistersincrime.org.au and our email address is admin@sistersincrime.org.au. Until next Friday then, when we bring you another scintillating story from Australian women crime creators.